Good evening, Johannes Bieringer. Thank you very much for accepting this interview. You are a choreographer, a media artist, and artistic director of Alien Nation, a Houston-based multimedia ensemble that has collaborated on numerous site-specific and cross-cultural performance and installation projects since 1993. You're also a professor at Brunel University, London School of Arts, and you are director of DAP Lab, the Center for Contemporary and Digital Performance, since 2008 to 2015, and curating the annual research seminar series and Art of Forum. You have a long list of works, research. My first question is, how is the pandemic affecting your activities?
That's a bad start, but first of all, good evening, Luca, and thank you for providing this occasion to speak. In fact, yesterday I had a conversation with an anthropologist friend who told me that she finds Zoom teaching very exhausting and difficult in this particular time we are in now, because I think many, many, many colleagues here at my university are teaching online or have moved to teaching online. And she said she now prefers to play her students' podcasts because she thinks they're finding it easier to listen to a voice and to imagine what the voice is telling. Yeah. So, yeah, for me, I'm actually teaching in the studio. I figured that I will not be able to teach instruments, technical instruments, and the digital process just online. So we are working with a mask. And since all of this happened upon us, I went through different phases, Luca. I mean, in the beginning, I was surprised and shocked. And the lockdown was a new experience for me because we can only remember stories from the elders, elder generations who perhaps remember curfews or being in an isolation shelter, but I have never experienced this imposition of measures by governments, and you may imagine when I traveled from London to Germany to retreat to my house in the countryside, I had to cross about 5 borders, and they had not been there before. So when I drove from London to Dover and then Calais, France, Belgium, Luxembourg, Germany, they all had their border guards stopping me. And yeah, so that was a shock. But very soon, in April, May, June, July, the retreat into my childhood countryside, where I grew up in the Saarland in southwest Germany, a small region near the French-Luxembourg border, I found it very inspiring that time had slowed down and space had opened up. And I was doing a lot of exploration of countryside, nature, environments, and this very soon became for me a creative enterprise. So I'll stop here. Yeah, I actually walk, so am I running in the country, almost like in musical terms for you. Yeah, it would be like field recordings. And I started then to take my camera with me and record myself. I've been doing this since April, and now I'm trying to, you know, convey some of that learning experience to the students, because some of them, especially if they have to self-isolate, for example, the young students are in dormitories, and we have had some cases of positive testing, so then they have to stay in their rooms. So I have to, you know, communicate to them through Zoom and through the camera, but I try to make it playful and experiential and adventurous. Yeah. So that's my answer. For me, the pandemic has been a true adventure. Also, in, if I may say so, reestablishing social connection, not distance, connection, because in my valley in Schmelz, many people were out walking or, you know, with their dogs or jogging, bicycling, mountain climbing, hill climbing. I saw a group of women doing yoga on a hilltop. I saw young people, you know, straying interesting new games, playing interesting games that I didn't quite know, in distance, but still together. And I think also listening to sounds in the nature where I live, I had never done it in quite the same way.
Well, it's kind of paradoxal for someone that has worked many years with digital performance. So I want to ask you why embodiment or re-embodiment is essential in your work. Because your research involves and has involved contemporary and digital performance indeed. And the question is, what was the role of the digital when you started the research on this topic? And what was your vision back then? Because in your essay, Chemosphere or Shamans in the Blind Country, you mentioned that in the mid-90s, it had only begun to work with computers and develop interactive performance. But already through the 80s, you realized that photographic filmic projection in live art or site-specific performance manifestation or the assemblage of different objects, scale, landscape, sound, material with movement and time required different understanding of the animated settings for the works. Can you dive into this trajectory from, let's say, the 80s until now, in order to understand this idea of chemosphere and the kinetic atmosphere from then until now, in this paradoxical situation?
All right. Yes, perhaps we will arrive at a bit of discussion of what I now construct as kinetic atmospheres. But to look back, as you're asking me about the trajectory, I think I can say that my training is in theater. Although I did not maybe follow a traditional professional school career studying acting or directing, but I came through it through literature and my interest in poetry and in history. So in a way, I was a very literary person who then completely switched into a physical passion and interest in movement. And I think, if I may tell the anecdote, it's a very simple anecdote. I'm a MA student under a very wonderful professor, still in Germany at the time before I emigrated to the United States, and he says, you must go to the annual Shakespeare Tagung in Bochum. I said, yes. So we go to Bochum, and in the evenings they treat us to theater, and we went to the Schauspielhaus, and I saw the first performance by Pina Bausch, who at that point was not very well known and certainly not among Shakespeare scholars. And the evening performance that she offered was a paraphrase from Macbeth, that she took a stage direction from Macbeth, a simple line. She takes him by the hand and leads him into the castle. The others follow. This is the night when Lady Macbeth incites Macbeth to kill Duncan. But Pina Bausch stages this one line as a 3.5-hour physical dance anatomy, and almost you could say surgery, of certain physical emotional states that she was trying to associate to the murder. Guilt, obsession, panic, anticipation, erotic anxiety, jealousy, all these emotions that can be somehow explored physically. And I saw this, not a single word was spoken. It was all movement, and it fascinated me. And then when I moved to the United States and continued my theater study, I thought I need to work with dancers and I need to perhaps expand this physicality a little bit, because at that point 87, 88, 89, I got my hands onto my first video camera, and I was also shooting still images, still using the old projectors, slide projectors, and I thought I can begin to mix movement, image projection, and sound. And at that time, I had not worked with computers yet or with software, still with live musicians. But in the 90s, as you mentioned, I was invited to Amsterdam to my first software conference workshop. And that's when I realized now my colleagues who are more advanced in this, especially in music technology and coming from, I think, music, they had a deeper knowledge already of electroacoustic and then, I suppose, electronic sound, which then became digital. And so the first software lies on the table. It's the one I had was called Big Eye, and you connect the camera to your laptop, and this Big Eye allows you then to do something with the camera vision. And so this is the beginning of my learning about software, and then understanding that data is one thing, or synthesis or live processing real time. The other thing is continuing my passion, my interest in movement, and my understanding of how bodies are our primary instruments. And so for me, the analog and the digital are always interconnected and entangled. Yeah. And so, Luca, to finish this little story up, as you grow in your understanding of these art forms or performance modes, you begin to combine them. You then realize, okay, there is a stage performance or concert that you do to the audience, and then there is installation where the audience comes inside, or where your very nervous system, as David Rokeby called it in the 90s, or maybe even earlier in the 80s, the very nervous system is installed in the room, so that however the audience moves, in whatever way they engage, whatever happens in the space, that affects what we hear, what we might see. And so this interconnection between what we do and what we experience with our sentient bodies, and then what happens in terms of projection or diffusion of sound, that became, you know, my main mode of operation. Sometimes as dance, sometimes as installation, sometimes as a small film, sometimes as telematics, you know, working networked. I remember when I came to Belfast to visit you, there was a networked music performance one night that we saw. And you came to Göttelborn to the Interaktionslabor, where we were working site-specifically in a very beautiful old industrial environment. But we wanted to use the old architecture as a space to maybe work very carefully into the more futuristic digital. Yeah. Now, to end, I'm on my way back to the analog more and more because I really love physical materials. And I'm not an engineer, so I can't invent new possible, you know, combinations of circuitry, you know, I mean, software circuitry and raw materials. But I really love to work with raw materials. And they, as you remember, Luca, when you recorded the bat in the coal mine, or we were banging on iron or metal, the metal creates sound, and then you sample it, and then new things begin to happen.
Sure. But in the title of the essay, Chemosphere, I mean, you just explain this kinetic...
Atmosphere.
And kinetic atmosphere. So I would like to have a little insight on this. But also, what kind of architecture does it build, since it is mostly material, and how you integrate the idea of extended choreographic, sensorial and experiential perception, and new forms of spatial and kinetic composition. And around this, what interests me is why phenomenology play a role in such architecture and choreographies.
All right. These are several not easy questions. The last one I probably don't quite know how to address because I'm not an expert in phenomenology, but these last few days, a lot of conversations I had were about sentience, what we feel and perceive through our sensory relationship to the environment. And I think this is key for me, that the embodiment, as I understand it, has to do with the way our sensory perception system, all the many senses, not just a few, yeah, listening and hearing and touching and seeing, but there are these smaller micro senses on the skin and in the back of our head and in the hair and everywhere. So we are an organism that perceives and lives in the world. And I think 5-6 years ago noticed that some of the spaces I was working in were quite large, old factory halls or grand halls that were stone or black boxes. And here I now need to mention my design partner and collaborator Michel Donjou, because that's another accident in my trajectory, that after 1980 I moved to the United States. So after about 25 years, and you know, I used to be based in Houston, Texas, where my company was. But in 2004-05, I end up in Nottingham as a research fellow in the same group with Stella, who was this mad, you know, experimenter with. He used to ironically speak of the obsolete body that you need to expand, yeah? So he put contraptions on it. I ran into Michel Donjou, who was a fashion designer, and since I had never had the pleasure of working with a fashion designer, I asked her, would you like to work with me? And so in the next few years, as we were collaborating, et cetera, with other, you know, artists who perhaps had a strong engineering background or could build things, Michel designed these wearables that could be worn on the body and generate sound or transmit data, and thus allow us through the movement to affect image projection, graphic projection, and the sonics. So out of that collaboration, and then with the DAP Lab in 2015, I began to think that not only is the body a performance agent that can wear things and move things around, but the space itself could be, I don't want to say wearable, could become wearable, but could have elements in it that move or shift or alter their texture depending on whatever we do, yeah, to modify the perception of these textures, colors, material qualities. And of course, that meant more collaboration. Yeah. So in Madrid in 2015, through the European-sponsored MetaBody project, I got invited to work with architects. And it was a whole team from the Netherlands, from Delft. And they had built this structure, this wall that could move because it had sensors and it had a Kinect camera built in that could observe me as I move closer to it or away from it and then change its colorization. It had two colors, a kind of reddish and bluish tint. And then it could also open and close its structural manifestation. So it was a wall that was built out of a polypropylene material and looked like an origami texture, very beautiful. And they suspended this from the ceiling and had little motors, small motors attached to it so that the thing could move. And of course, we are now, you know, that's kinetic art. That goes back to all these things that sculptors invented that could move or hang or float or shift, yeah? And so we did a dance performance in conjunction with them. And then to my dismay, they said afterwards, so that's it, we move on, we have other projects now. And they left the origami lying in the corner. So I inherited it and I took it home to London. So we've been working with it in other ways, hanging it up like a sail, putting it on the floor, projecting on top of it, letting people lie inside it. Michelle built a dress out of the same type of polypropylene material that when it was worn by the dancer, it crackled and crickled and crockled, yeah? And so we had elements in the space now that were plastics or fabrics, and then also our performance artists were working with these costumes, and then we felt that the next step is to let this atmosphere be an architectural installation. And with architecture, I mean elements that are shapes and materials that are draped from the ceiling or that create pathways or in a way like a building when you have a corridor affects you the way you walk through the corridor or up the stairs. Yeah, we try to have these elements in the space that were both physical and digital. And the last addition we made is we had a friend who took part in some of our rehearsals, Doros Polidoru, and he said, VR, yeah, we must include VR so people go through the real landscape and atmosphere, and then we give them the headset, and then they're also seeing a virtual landscape. While, this is the notion of augmented virtuality in an atmosphere where you hear things, you feel things, you see things, but then something touches you. And that's what I really enjoy lately. It's a bit clunky, yeah? So imagine you have your visitor, your audience member in the goggles, and they have to do it one after the other because we only had one or two of these headsets. So the person is inside a virtual world which is synthetic, but then something touches their cheeks, or they notice the wind is getting colder, or suddenly their feet are on sand, yeah? Because we put the sand there, and we put the fan on to create the wind, and we touched the visitor with a twig of a branch, yeah? Yes, and I cannot imagine to become a VR designer at all, but it was interesting that as a newer, yeah, 3D technology that is now becoming available, and you know people are talking about the HoloLens and holography and so on, I think I added it to the architectural choreography. And again, I'm maybe using the terms in a free spirit, yeah? Expanded choreography for me means that you include these sculptural dimensions that are physical, but also they can have sonic properties, yeah? So they are always sort of ambiguous and beautiful and poetic, yeah? Some of the little things we've built are simple things, but you give them to an audience member, and when they start rubbing it or something, they make sound, yeah? So that's the larger notion of an atmosphere in which things move or in which things can be transformative for your perception, yeah?
Sure. So there is a term that I saw, which is the term, German term, Umwelt. So how does it relate to architecture and choreography? And furthermore, into your research, what it means, what is Umwelt?
Yeah, as you, of course, very well know, I think it goes back to Jakob von Uexküll, who at the turn of the 19th or the 20th century was doing environmental psychology and environmental studies. Today, I think it would perhaps be considered ecological environmental study, and he spoke of Umwelt not just as Umgebung, like environment, but as a living organic, multiplex cosmos, where these different life forms and organisms, they all have their own perceptional systems, and they exist, in parallel with us. And so when you think of kinetic art or constructed architectures where the architect or the sculptor puts elements in the room that may even be partly organic, or, we've had mushrooms in our last dance performance, both real mushrooms that we found on the field, and one of the collaborators we worked with built some synthetic mushrooms that could move. And so we might have these elements in it or in the environment that help us to imagine the whole as a poetic cosmos that has this environmental perhaps subtext. And when I say subtext, I, for example, my last dance work that I created with the company, Mourning for a Dead Moon, last December we premiered it in London. It was addressing the climate catastrophe, global warming, and we started very simply looking at mushrooms. And that was inspired not by Uexküll and his work on Umwelt, but by Anna Lovenhaupt-Zing and her recent book, Life in the Ruins of Capitalism. And it is a book on mushrooms because she studied the Matsutake, a Japanese mushroom that became very rare in Japan. And so it had to be foraged and hunted in other places in Russia, in China, in Oregon, in Finland, where it grows in dilapidated forests. And I'm very fond and I feel very close to forests because I grew up in one. And so we brought real forest elements onto the stage along with the mushrooms to also evoke this this idea of a natural environment that had other elements in it that have to do with movement and with sound and with dance.
Okay. You also mentioned in your work defocusing perception and peripheral perception. But why is this important to you?
Well, going back to the notion of the wearable, when Michelle and I started to build, when she started to build these costumes that I then had to explore with the dancers, and noticing that sometimes it was difficult for the performer to move because the wearable might constitute an encapsulation or an encumbrance. So it makes it more difficult to move in a natural way, and you have to move in a different way. For example, with the head dress that she built, or very tight costumes, or very heavy materials that are embracing you. It affects your perception kinesthetically. So when you are now looking at it from the point of view of the dancer, you have to orient yourself in a new way towards your environment because you're wearing a very complicated outfit or accoutrement, or your wearable emits data and therefore makes sound, and you have to sort of learn, oh, if I move the elbow in this way, the sound changes, or when I go down in a lower position, shifting my sense of gravity, something happens. And to me, that is, I think, what I think is the answer to your question. I phenomenologically, kinesthetically, or proprioceptively, I realize things that happen to my bodily perception and my bodily movement, orientation, sense of where I am, perhaps my peripheral vision and my hearing. And in 2016-17 we had one installation where I, through a friend of mine in London who works with people who are blind and vision impaired. We had people come to our exhibition who were blind. So we knew that would be a wonderful opportunity for us to learn how people who have different abilities in their perception react to an environment that they feel, you know, and experience differently. And I think I'm now ready to look at the pandemic and this question of social distance and re-embodiment that perhaps has to happen. Yeah, how will we re-embody maybe next year if we start having workshops again? And at the moment, I'm thinking that working with mask, yeah, I teach with the mask, already shifts my self-awareness because I feel very hot and I feel my voice is not traveling in the same way. And so my senses are hyperactive now. I'm trying to imagine how I am being perceived, you know. Perhaps I'm not articulate anymore because my voice is muffled. So these are, I think, sensorial aspects that can lead to new creativities. And maybe also to add one more element about the Umwelt, to a better understanding of our need to perhaps be very gentle and careful with our world and our environment. And I mentioned the example of one of the costumes that Michelle built for the last moon dance. She collected plastic over a period of 6 weeks, just from household, yeah, that you would normally separate and then it would be retrieved by when they come around, yeah. So we had this large material pile of plastics, and she built a dress for our Chinese dancer Zhe Xu, who then learned how to imagine himself becoming a plastic fish or person or someone who imbibes. You know, the fish have died because they eat plastic in the water, yeah, in the ocean, because of the pollution. So he was wearing the plastic coming out of his mouth and danced with this. And I think he was imagining also this inside-outside relationship, something that's outside of us and, yeah, but also something we take in, we eat, yeah. And you may recall, Luca, there was an incident in Germany in the summer where they had to close down the meat factories in Gütersloh because there was a huge outbreak of corona virus infections in a meat slaughterhouse, yeah, where 400 or 500 workers were working in very small space, yeah, killing pigs. And I had never seen images from inside a slaughterhouse until that day. And it was horrifying, you know, and then to imagine it also, that we are eating so much, which is not perhaps even healthy, yeah, for humankind, and certainly it's not healthy for animals who have to die.
Yeah, the precarity of the workers, yeah. On one hand, but also probably the animals, but also necessity of these workers.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's we can make another podcast just on that. I would love.
There is, I think, a story by a novelist called Slaughterhouse Five. I think it's a U.S. novelist, and I think that was a book that a friend of mine once wanted to dramatize, but I've forgotten now who wrote it. But I think this whole question of our, as you say, the precarity in our relations to the earth, I think it must now inspire a new thought in the same way in which the whole summer wave of protests, you know, about racial injustice and violence against black people, how that again raised consciousness in terms of how we want to, you know, shape the future also in terms of our teaching and learning and understanding.
Yeah. I will invite you straight away for another discussion just on that, because No, it's huge and it's super important, actually. It's dear to me. I would like to continue on this perception, and we discussed about deep listening and the underground in previous discussions. So how you integrate, I mean, you said that the material have own sound, etc., but how you envision deep listening in your performance, and also how you contextualize the underground here, I mean, specifically in your work.
Yes, that's a new, I would say, development, because I did not quite see it coming. I last year had a bit of free time, a sabbatical, and I spent it in Texas. And I was invited to use the time to do a workshop, and I collaborated with anthropologists in Houston, and we decided that it would be interesting to look at the space below, the underground, the actual ground below the ground level. And I think my anthropologist colleague was interested in water reservoirs, access to water, and how the whole concept of who owns water, or how does it get from down there to up here, and so on. So she was interested in water. I didn't have any preconception. I just knew from Pauline Oliveros, who I have met a few times, and I listened to her concerts, and I think she was the one who coined the notion in the music community of deep listening. And I think it was inspired by her going down to a cave one day and experiencing the different, I suppose, sound quality being below. And in our workshop, we chose to make field trips to three sites, and I, of course, took my camera and my audio recorder with me, because the idea was not just to experience the underground. We went to a tunnel system, we went to a cistern in Houston that was a former water reservoir, now abandoned, and then we went to a geological cave in San Antonio, an old limestone cave, millions of years old. And each of these spaces was explored physically, for me sensorially, several hours spending in that space, being in that space. And then, of course, we wanted to do an exhibition at the end of our research, bringing some of the things we've discovered and transforming them into something that could be exhibited, meaning sound, perhaps visual objects, film, yeah, and so on. But for me, the exhibition was less important, and I departed before it actually opened. I left Houston the week before, which is a different story. But in the process, for me, it was for me, first time experience. Let's say there are people who go into caves and they know so much about caves and stalactites and stalagmites and the dripping water. But I became interested in the echo, in the volume, in the volumetric space, in the temperature and moisture, and then in the textures of the walls and what I would be hearing. Yeah, and that meant to be quiet and really focusing on a deeper sense of listening, learning from that, and then in my subsequent theater workshops with dancers and anthropology students, we try to work in the same mode, namely have a few objects that we had brought into the studio, organic objects, stone, wood, a few rocks, and then palm fronds. These are the leaves of the palm trees. And I wanted them to listen to these elements. Imagine, you know, their sound, or if you touch them or move them or move with them, very fine, delicate sounds would be generated. And so for me, the work actually was, again, a sensory discovery, But what happens in the cave is unique because you are confronted with geological environments that are very old. And I think the moisture of the limestone and the echo, yeah, that you hear there, that was for me a fascinating experience. And it's not possible, I believe, to translate that into an exhibition. One of the artists who was with us suggested, okay, we're there with the team, we have cameras, so let's work. And the task was to do photogrammetry. So you are doing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of photographs in a 360 circle, high level, mid level, low level. So you then have all these image files, and from those files, there is software now that can generate VR footage, yeah, a 360 degree film material. And so we did that, but and I have a small clip of that that I sometimes show when I talk about this work. But I prefer to talk physically about what it meant in the tunnel system to be very low, to crawl. Some of the tunnels are 100 years old. And in the tunnel system at the university, they are sending pipes with water and steam to cool and to heat the facility. So it's a huge system in which steam and water is channeled. And we recorded the point at which, this is the engineer explaining it to me, he took us on a first and sort of an introduction to the tunnel system. There are these steam traps where the steam gets trapped and then it makes clicking, crackling noises. It's just like crackle music, yeah? And it's beautiful, and I tried to record some of that, and it fascinated me that this space itself generates these sounds and you can listen to them, yeah?
Deep listening from Pauline Oliveros.
Yeah.
I mean, you touched the point. One final question would be, why are ritual important here?
Yeah, that's possibly a social political question, because especially in this summer, when I was outdoors, I thought to myself, social distancing, self-isolation, curfew, lockdown, theaters closed, no concerts, no choir, no orchestra, yeah? So if theater goes back in anthropological sense to forms of ritual, sacred ritual, and later on, you know, a secular ritual, as we still perform our gatherings, yeah, or our funerals and our weddings. I thought maybe if we do certain outdoor performances and they begin to appear ritualistic, people can tap into them, or we can invent new rituals, or we can go back to some older rituals. I don't know, harvest time, yeah, when the apples are falling from the trees. I think ritual is an existential necessity for all living beings, I think. And I believe right now is a very good time to ask questions about how, especially with the high-tech development, you know, when you go to a technology conference or festival, people are trying to persuade you to have your own artificial intelligence bot that you talk to, or you have your measuring devices on your body so you can always check your sugar levels and blood pressure. So we are biometrically surveilling ourselves, and the engineers are very excited about possibilities in artificial intelligence and so on. But I'm more interested in the question of how we as a species and as a society can rediscover shared space. So in the Tsing book that I mentioned earlier, Mushroom Life at the End of Capitalism, she mentions, I think, a term that you must know very, very well. I believe it goes back to the Alemann German, latente Allmende, an Allmende. An Allmende is, I think, a common shared plot of land where people are growing things and harvesting things, but it belongs to everyone. Yeah. And I think this notion of a commons that also then includes perhaps a creative gathering, storytelling, ritual is I think, vital at this point where I think people are really questioning what's happening. If everyone now works in the home office, then, you know, you have to at some point go outside, right? And we have to meet again and do things. So I'm created a new research group here. It's called Performance and Ephemeral Sustainability. That's a small paradox, but, you know, do ephemeral actions, but repeat them and make them sustainable like a ritual. Does that make sense?
Totally. Good. Yeah, totally. Thank you very much. I have still one very last question. What's next for you?
Well, you know, I'm getting older, and I have been writing a book on kinetic atmospheres, and it's finished now. And I had to change direction a bit near the end because of the changed circumstances in which we live, because I was describing intimacy as an important aspect of our visceral sensorial experience. But if we are now going to have to be more careful, the notion of intimacy and distance became an interesting point to reflect on. But I obviously hope to continue to make dance work and small films. And I am enjoying very much working with my Chinese PhD colleague. He's doing his PhD on dance and technology. And Zhe Xu has been showing me all these old traditional Chinese cultural things that he used to dance with. Fans, scarves, red bands. He even has included chopsticks in his performance. And now he brought from China, he had it sent to him, two red stilts, gao, because there is a folk dance that's performed on stilts. And he said he has forgotten it now. But I said to him, well, but the stilt could be used in different ways, yeah? And so he's working on a choreography with stilts that become extensions of the body and perhaps re-evoke the notion of a cultural symbol. And at the same time, maybe it's a technical instrument that could be sonified or, you know, that could function as a sensor. And with the history of the stilt, we're coming full circle to the Umwelt, because I was interested in what Gao Chao goes back to. So I looked it up. And in the old times, people, when they were harvesting plums or apples from the tree, they took a long stick and they knocked them down and someone would catch them. And then later they thought, oh, or the stick, we can stand on the stick, yeah, and then reach. And then out of the standing on the stick became the stilt as a dance. And I think it's for me quite beautiful to be reminded that these things come from somewhere, yeah? And you've been in Africa, you know that instruments, they are built because of certain maybe traditions that...
Necessities.
Yeah.
What I brought from Africa, but also, Southeast Africa, because it's a continent. And Brazil, it's really the notion of necessity. You do things because you have to. But what interests me here is this idea of intimacy with the prosthetics.
Yes.
So maybe that's the future. I don't know. I hope not.
When I left the exhibition in Houston because of a family necessity, my oldest brother became paralyzed, and we were thinking, oh, he will be in a wheelchair. What will he do now? Yeah. So I tried to encourage him to do a rehabilitation to see whether he could stand up and so on. But it was a new challenge for him, the loss of the leg. Yeah. And, you know, anything can happen to us. We could have an accident, you know, and suddenly you have no more arms. Yeah. And then you learn other ways, I suppose. Oh, it was wonderful. This conversation is, I think, a much better way to dig into material than a lecture. So this was very wonderful. Thank you for inviting me.
It's always a great pleasure to listen to you. I go on and on, but there is already apparently another episode that is coming. Okay, thank you very much, Johannes.
Thank you.
Take good care of yourself.
Thank you.